This is a download from the BBC. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radiowales.
Hello, I'm Roy Jenkins. Welcome to All Things Considered, where today we look back on the way we've reflected some of the big events of the year. 2010 has given us a Westminster coalition and some unpleasant indications of what the economic squeeze will feel like. Hundreds of thousands of people lost everything in natural disasters, and British troops continue to die in Afghanistan. But the year also brought us cheering stories. The astonishing rescue of the Chilean miners, the surprising success of the Pope's visit, and the soggy triumph of Wales's first Ryder Cup. There was lots more besides, and week by week we've tried to offer a distinctive perspective. It's with two of the most devastating disasters that we begin. An earthquake in Haiti in January shattered an already near-destitute country. The Reverend Dr. Leslie Griffiths, once a Methodist minister there, described his reaction to Peter Baker.
I've been in touch both directly and indirectly with a number of people who've been affected by it. I was ordained, as it happens, in a church in Haiti that now is unsafe to worship in. I was deputy director of a large and prestigious school in the grounds of that church, which now is just a heap of rubble, and they pulled pupils and teachers and workers out of it, dead and alive, for days after the earthquake. There were people I taught who were missing, people I knew, people I loved. Many of them have gone, and others are traumatized for the rest of their lives.
How's all of that shaping your response to their suffering?
It's just a question of bewilderment. I'm a Christian preacher, believe in a loving God, feel that he wants the best for this world, gives us the gifts to make it into a better world than it is at the moment. And blow me, one thing after another comes along like this, and a fair proportion of them, or I should say an unfair proportion of them, hit the Haitian people. Four earthquakes in the last 2 years, a landslide, a collapsed school, loss of life on an extraordinary scale, political turmoil, and now this. So I can only say really that, as one of the folk song singers of Haiti put it in a song they put together after the earthquake, there aren't enough tears to weep for the people of Haiti at the moment.
Nor were there for the people of Pakistan, where floods affected 20 million. I asked Akmal Hanouk, trustee of the Muslim Council of Wales, how he made sense of such suffering in the light of his faith.
I think from our point of view, from the Muslim faith point of view, I think these are the times of test, times of trials and tribulations, and especially for the people who are the haves towards sharing, towards the have-nots. And I think that's what is the very prime thing. You know, it is beyond any caste or creed or color. And it has to be taken out as a very responsibility towards the people who are suffering.
But do you get people asking, well, how on earth can there be a loving God, a good God, if these things are allowed to happen? Is that a question which comes up among people in your community?
I think these sorts of questions come up from the people who actually do not understand their relationship with God or relationship with the Creator. The one example that I can give you is that, and you might have seen it on the television as well, a lot of the people, even in all the misery, in all this, they have lost their animals, they've lost their food, they've lost their loved ones and dear ones, and yet you would see people who are fasting because it's Ramadan. Mm-hmm. When this kind of thing happens, there's a natural question of, okay, where is the loving God and where is that? But the question should be turned around, that when God is also asking you for some kinds of duties that we owe to him, are we doing that? We have to have those rights and obligations in place, you know, because the scale is so huge that when we are talking about food, shelter, medicine, rehabilitation, I think it's going to be over the years that has to come through.
Rights and obligations and the duty of the haves to the have-nots have also formed part of the debate in this country about how the national deficits to be addressed. Churches and other faith-based groups have warned that welfare cuts will cause misery and hardship for the most vulnerable. We discussed the implications of the Chancellor's comprehensive spending review with Welsh banker Martin Lewis, Ingrid Wilson from Community House in Newport, and first Rachel Lampard of the Free Church's Joint Public Issues Group.
I think you have to recognise that when people are living on benefits and are surviving on an incredibly low income compared to even to the average income, actually existing in itself is quite a struggle. I don't think a lot of it is people haven't made the effort to go out. It's just that day-to-day existence on a very low income is hard work. Planning ahead what you can actually afford to buy for the family to eat that night. You can't afford to bulk buy. You can't afford to make any mistakes that people with a, you know, bit of a cushion, a bit of a buffer in their income would have. Day to day, it is a very, very hard existence. It is not cushy, and I don't think people really would ever choose it as a lifestyle choice.
You must see some of this in your work through the community house in Newport, Ingrid.
Yes, certainly. We come across people from all different areas of deprivation. And I'm just thinking of one particular person who was in an abusive relationship, was left with two young children, and is also the carer for a very sick mother. And so she, rather than being able to go out to work, has had to get some housing support, and her mother is on disability living allowance. They are really struggling to be able to cope every day. And then in June, when we had the first spending review, the cuts meant a reduction in the housing benefit, and at the same time, her rent was increased. And she's now stuck with that double shortfall at the same time. So she had the choice, do I move house, disrupt my sick mother, my young children? When she looked into the finances of it, she couldn't afford to move house because, as Rachel said, she didn't have a cushion to be able to even deal with the costs of moving her belongings from one place to another. So she's had to take on that. Now that the weather has got colder, she is only putting the heating on for 1 hour a day because she cannot afford to put more money into the gas meter.
Are you comfortable with that sort of thing, Martin?
No, not at all. And that's where I say you've got to try and work out what are the true poor, the vulnerable poor, the needy in this situation, versus the alternative side of the story that Rachel talked about, is when you see a family with 12 children taking £90,000-£95,000 in state benefits.
That is very, very rare, isn't it?
Maybe
it's
not.
It's a sort of tabloid
it is,
figure,
you know,
isn't it?
But then, you know, recently we've seen 75% of those on long-term sick are fit to work. And these are challenges that everybody has to face. I'm not saying that some of the answers are easy, but we have to ask the question.
For a few days in the autumn, many people put worries about the economic downturn to one side as Wales hosted one of the world's most prestigious sporting events. The multi-million pound extravaganza of the Ryder Cup brought the world's top golfers to Wales, got them thoroughly soaked, but recorded a great hit. In the run-up, Peter Baker talked to Bernhard Langer, a former world number one, twice a winner of the Masters, with over 80 tournament career victories to his name, a true icon of the sport. He's been a Ryder Cup stalwart for Europe for many years, but not all his experiences of the tournament have been happy ones.
We have to talk about that famous missed putt at the Ryder Cup at Kiawah Island in 1991. It was a massive pressure point, wasn't it? Had you putted it, Europe would have retained the Ryder Cup, but it didn't happen. You missed it just a little. It's one of those sporting moments where everyone seems to remember it. What impact did it have on you and on your teammates at the time?
Well, first of all, I was obviously disappointed because I had just come back from being two down with four holes to play, and I made three very good putts to get back to even, and now all I had to do is make the 6-foot putt to win. But there's one problem. I had a huge spike mark, actually two spike marks on the line I wanted to putt it. My caddy Peter Coleman and I read greens together, and I asked him, where do you see this putt? And he said, left edge. And I said, that's where I see it. But he said, well, what about the spike marks? I said, yeah, I'll see him too. So I changed my line instead, because I didn't want to hit the spike marks and the ball would ricochet sideways. So I said, I'll putt it straight to miss the spike marks and hopefully it won't break as much. But it did break to the right and missed on the right lip. So at first it was a lot of disappointment, felt bad for the team. You know, there was Savvy was kind of crying and a bunch of other guys were very emotional. the American crowd cheered and celebrated their team. I was disappointed, obviously, and felt bad for all the team. But it didn't take too long to get over it. It sat with me for a few days, and I traveled from there, from Kiowa to Stuttgart, where I played my own tournament, the German Masters at the time. And, you know, the first question that was asked in the media center, what was it like to miss that putt? And I'm still hearing it now, you know.
Sorry.
20 years later. That's part of history, and I don't mind talking about it. But I realized then that this will be something that will probably be talked about for a long time, and it's part of my career in history golf. And there's nothing wrong with that. But
did your faith help you at all?
It sure did, yes. This was 91, so I've already been a Christian for 6 years. So I didn't ask the question anymore, why me? God, why did you let this happen to me? I looked at it differently. I thought, well, you know, let's see if my faith is strong enough to just trust God and have enough faith and just get on with it and believe that he knows what's best for me, and he won't give me more than I can handle.
Wales also played host this year to a very different event, the UK's Second Armed Forces Day. And as the British death toll in Afghanistan passed the 300 mark, we explored attitudes to military service with Tudor Botwood, a naval chaplain from Radnorshire, and retired army chaplain Jim Cross. Is Armed Forces Day a good idea in itself, I asked.
It's an interesting idea, isn't it? It's been really interesting over the last sort of 8 years of my career in the armed forces to see the way in which, 8 years ago we were more or less tolerated. And once we started losing large numbers of armed forces, to see the way in which the people have responded to that loss. So, yeah, I think Armed Forces Day is a really good idea and a really good thing. But it's just nice to feel appreciated, Roy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also good for the nation as a whole to realise what what the young men and young women are doing.
Jim Cross, you've been in the services. How do you feel about it?
I feel deeply disapproving of it, actually. I feel Remembrance Sunday is the right time to remember the armed forces, and that brings the country together because there are so many people older who have served in the armed forces and who appreciate it. The armed forces of the present day are remembered, and remembered with affection and respect, as they should be.
But people are there supporting the troops, Jim?
Well, I'm all for them supporting the troops as the troops, and supporting their families and everything else. But I suspect that when the, and this is going to be a deeply hurtful thing to say, but I think I ought to say it to be honest, I think that when they started reading out the role of the dead at the beginning of Prime Minister's questions in Parliament, I think it was a trick. And I think it was done to hijack our respect for those who had died and actually take away the sting of Prime Minister's questions. I think that Armed Forces Day has been a political hijack.
Let me just ask Tudor, how do you react to that? I mean, did you object to the reading out of these names in Parliament?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, Roy, isn't it? You do have the impression on times that because this is a, I think, respect for the armed forces and Armed Forces Day and all the events, that they just take off on their own. And there is a sense in which I think it's very easy to hijack something that the general public really want to do. And I think we have always got to just watch the politicians don't take the glory for something that just normal people
want
to do.
Wooden Bassett is an honest respect for the armed forces display, and I think that has developed and developed well. And everybody, I think, has moved to see it happen.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to All Things Considered on BBC Radio Wales, and this is our review of the year. Some of the methods adopted in recent conflicts continue to haunt members of military and security services and their political masters. When we spoke to former Anglesey MP Keith Best, he'd just taken up his new job as chief executive of the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture.
I never cease to be amazed at the fortitude of these people who've gone through things that, quite frankly, most of us would not even imagine. And not only is it their fortitude in coming through that, but the enormous skills and talents these people have. We have an art therapy group. They produce beautiful works of art. We have a poetry group. We have people who are learning to write prose. These are extraordinarily talented people who, frankly, are an asset to any society.
So the Medical Foundation helps provide welfare for people, it helps to rehabilitate people who have undergone torture, but it's also a campaigning organisation. It has a bigger agenda, and not everyone, I suspect, is comfortable with that, with the notion that, you know, you say torture is always wrong, for instance, and we live at a time when governments have been arguing, well, maybe it isn't quite as simple as that.
Well, torture is always wrong, and what alarms me is the way in which we now see creeping into so-called civilised countries' debates whether, in some cases, a torture of terror suspects, for example, is justified in order to try to stop further terrorist outrages.
But some people would say that people like yourself, opponents of torture generally, are simply refusing to face reality, that there are real pressures on security service, military, politicians. Nobody wants an atrocity to happen on their watch. And sometimes there is no alternative.
If in order to defeat terrorism, you adopt the same immoral attitudes of the terrorists by torturing people or by removing civil liberties in this age-old cry, we'll take away your civil liberties because it'll make you more safe, then we have done the terrorist job for them. If we fail to maintain our civilized values in the face of unscrupulous attacks by terrorists, then we truly have succumbed to the terrorists. I do not think that that is a credible position for a civilized society to take.
Nothing new about torture, of course. Before a unique service at Westminster Cathedral in the summer, we heard about the priest John Roberts, a farmer's son from Trawsfynydd in Gwynedd, who was martyred at Tyburn in 1610 and canonized in the last century. Keith O'Brien has spent 9 years researching his life.
He was the first monk to return to England after the dissolution of the monasteries by Henry VIII. And because of that, he's considered to be a second Augustine. By the Catholics, they consider that to be a very important point. Other priests had returned, but he was the first monk.
So what did he actually do? I mean, did he go around preaching? Did he take services in secret? What did he do?
It was very much cloak and dagger and in secret and constantly followed by spies. One of the main things, not only the preaching and taking mass in secret, not only that, the plague was always around in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, and this was very much what brought John Roberts back many times to England, particularly to London, to help those that were suffering from the plague, able to nurse some back to full health and others to be able to give them the final sacraments.
He was exiled?
Exiled every time, yes. I mean, he knew that being a priest in the realm was the ultimate penalty, was hanging, drawing and quartering. He knew that that would face him if he was caught here, but the governments were also trying not to rock the boat too much, and more often than not, priests were exiled.
So this happened a number of times to him?
4 or 5 times.
Yeah. So how did it come about that he was actually killed? Why didn't they simply put him in prison again or send him out of the country again or whatever?
Well, looking at what the records say, and particularly when the case was being heard in front of the Bishop of London and Justice Coke, that they had, by that time, had a belly full of this chap that kept coming back. Enough was enough. So there was nothing for it for him but to face the ultimate penalty.
So what do we know about those last hours?
Well, we know that he was thrown into a dungeon and then the final day, dragged behind a horse, up to Tyburn, to the gallows, and then placed on the gallows, hung nearly until death, so that you then would feel the rest of the pain of being opened up and disemboweled, and then quartered. Ordinarily, the disemboweling would take place whilst alive, and the heart would be held up by the executioner, saying, "Behold the heart of a traitor," and the crowd would then reply by saying, "Long live the king." But in John Roberts' case, the crowd were these cockneys that had received his help when they were suffering from the plague, and they remembered his kindness, and they insisted that the executioner hang him until death. And when his heart was pulled out and the executioner said, "Behold the heart of a traitor," there was total silence. Not a single word was uttered.
It's a grim story.
Very grim story.
There was more of a welcome this year for Pope Benedict. Many had feared that under fierce attack because of the church's handling of clerical abuse scandals, he'd be in for a stormy visit. In fact, it went better than his hosts had dared to hope, and many perceived gentleness and humility, a pontiff prepared to listen. On the eve of the visit, we asked several Catholics to assess his first 5 years. Mark Dowd, writer and broadcaster, Julia Holston Clark, a chaplain at Cardiff Prison, and first Paul Vallely, associate editor of the Independent newspaper.
I think it's been very mixed. I think, if I'm honest, I was apprehensive when he was elected. I thought he was going to be a force for reaction, and in some ways he has been, of course. But as the bishop said, he produced that fabulous letter on this first encyclical on love. On the other hand, he's obviously been very maladroit in terms of PR. It's almost like he's gone out of his way to offend people. And coupling his announcement of his visit to the UK with a condemnation of the UK's equality laws just seemed like, very tactless timing. So he's a very mixed bag.
A mixed bag. Julia?
Yeah, it was funny. There used to be a game when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, of quoting Ratzinger against Ratzinger. So, I've got some sympathy in that people do change their views. And I do get, his theology is beautiful. He's got a huge intellect and a huge heart. And I love the take-up of Cardinal Newman's heart and to heart theme. I suppose my hope is, what would redeem it for me would be for the state to be as equal weighted as a pastoral response to the genuine needs that we've got in Britain, the things that we really do need to hear, and the playing up of the good stuff, because that never gets in the press. I've got sympathy with him as a figurehead, but his PR really needs to be better than it is. It's funny, actually, I'm involved in part of the vigil that's been led by CAFOD in Hyde Park. But what's fantastic about that is it is a chance to showcase the ordinary Catholic work that's going on the ground, the people getting their hands dirty in the margins, and it is really good news. So I'm just hoping that maybe the coming together of Catholics who are just getting on with it, despite all these pronouncements, may actually redeem the visit in the public's eyes wider.
Mark, you've been making a lot of programmes about his visit. What do you make of him now?
I think one of the things that we really ought to congratulate him on, and this will be very counterintuitive for a lot of people, but I do think the sex abuse scandal is an area where, under his pontificate and in his own particular record, he deserves more credit than criticism. And a lot of people will find that controversial, but, I've gone into this in great detail. I've looked at the things that have been done, and there's a really tricky thing here for Catholics. The more you go into this, the more praise and plaudits you want to give to Pope Benedict, the more the finger of suspicion, I think, has to be pointed at his predecessor, because the evidence is now emerging that there were a lot of high-profile cases that were not dealt with by the Vatican during the pontificate of Pope John Paul II, which the Cardinal Ratzinger, as he was then, was thwarted in tackling, and it's only since he became Pope that various measures have come about. And there's one scene in particular which I think really deserves singling out. I was at Fatima in Portugal in May, and on his way there on the plane, he was asked by press journalists, "Is the church going to suffer for decades because of this abuse crisis?" And he stood there and he said to the journalists, "Look, there are some people who say this is a creation of the media. There's some people who say that abuse is a creation of society. I tell you squarely, this fault and sin is within the church, and it is up for us to sort ourselves." Decoding that, there's a raging battle going on at the moment in the Vatican between people who want to basically say this is all an attack by external forces and others who want to be more honest about it. And I think he's on the side of honesty and truth.
In fact, there was one of the other cardinals who locked horns with him over the way that the abuse scandal was being handled, and said, "Look, to Benedict, look, you're being unfair. You're giving these summary trials to priests and as it were not hearing their side of the story." And Benedict just said, "No, it's a scandal. It needs to be dealt with." And what the contemporary world can't understand is that Benedict doesn't want to do it in public. He doesn't want to do it through the courts. He doesn't want to do it through transparency and openness and all the things which are normal in a modern democracy. He wants to do it, in the kind of institutional privacy of the church, which is in my view a mistake. But it's wrong to suggest he's not doing anything about it.
We end with the most gripping story of the year, the rescue of the 33 miners after 69 days trapped underground in Chile. Everyone wanted to celebrate the courage, solidarity and joy of those men and the families who'd kept vigil. It might so easily have ended differently, as it did for miners in many other places. We chose the 50th anniversary of the explosion which claimed 45 lives at Six Bells, Abertillery, to mark the work of one of the most distinctive Welsh artists, Nicholas Evans, whose painting reflected his twin passions, coal mining and the Christian faith. I spent a fascinating morning in the Swansea Valley with his sons, Victor and Peter.
When he retired, he really got into it, you know, and couldn't paint enough, really. Whenever you'd call, he'd be there at his easel, you know, upstairs, little bedroom upstairs, and be working away, and he'd be saying, come on, come see what I've done, come in, you know.
He'd tell you, I've got six paintings in my mind now, you know, ready to... And he talked to them that as they were his children that were waiting to be born.
How long would it take him to produce a painting?
Days in some cases.
Yes.
A short time.
And my mother would have to call him to come to have a meal because he'd paint until it was going dark.
Yeah, he wouldn't care about time
He felt that painting was a form of worship for him. You know, everything in his life was... dictated to him then by his faith. It was all part of it. And he said at one time that he would like to be painting in heaven. That we'd be there, he said, forever and ever. And he'd like to take some time to paint there.
He probably thought there'd be plenty of room up there and plenty of light as well. Because where he was painting, it was a small bedroom with a small window in it, you know.
How soon did he start preaching?
Oh, very young. He was a young preacher. And, you know, he used to go and preach on his own on the street in the open air, you know, and the people would gather around him and somebody came and told his mother, oh, you want to see about that son? And he got religious mania. But it wasn't that. He was... It was because of his faith, he wanted to share it with other people.
Well, that's all we've time for in this review of the year. If you want to hear the programme again or download the free podcast, please go to bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales. All Things Considered will be here at the same time next week. But meanwhile, from me, Roy Jenkins, goodbye.